This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, it's been nearly 2 months since the warden approved compassionate release for Lynn Stewart, yet she remains in prison.
Attorney Ramsey Clark has been representing Lynn and her family on this, and we'll talk to him about what we can do to get her out of there.
We'll discuss some of the recent updates regarding the war on information.
An historic turning point. Is the internet going to be run from the top down by people who Cheney approves of? Or is it going to be run laterally as a democratic institution?
We'll learn how the Lakota Indians are filing UN genocide charges against the United States.
The Lakota Sioux, now living mostly in North Dakota, have been repelling efforts by the colonial American government for over 150 years to disperse their culture and their people. We'll talk about what's being done now to their children.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
It's been 7 weeks since Warden Jody Upton of FMC Carswell approved compassionate release for Lynn Stewart. This decision was based on the medical findings of stage 4 cancer that spread into Lynn's scapula, lymph nodes, and lungs. A massive vigil was held last week for Lynn at Federal Bureau of Prisons headquarters in Washington, D.C. We're joined today by former Attorney General of the U.S., Ramsey Clark, who is helping to get Lynn Stewart released from prison. Ramsey, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's good to be back. Thank you.
We're heartened to hear that you're assisting in the efforts to get Lynn Stewart released from prison on compassionate release. Can you give us a status of where that stands?
The warden at Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas, has recommended compassionate release. The matter is now on the desk of the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. It's been there for about 5 or 6 weeks, which is intolerably long because every day counts. Lynn's in desperate physical condition. Her cancer is spreading, and she has appointments at Sloan Kettering as soon as she can get out that may be able to extend her life. So it's extremely urgent that compassionate release be granted so she can come up here. They've already approved a place for her to live, but we want her in the hospital first where she can be treated and her life extended. It's slipping away while the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, who seems to be opposed to compassionate release, and at least any broad application of it, sits on her application. The law requires it be approved by the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and then it goes back to the sentencing judge, who we all seem to believe, I do certainly, that he would approve of compassionate release, and she would be on her way home and with her family and the medical care that gives her the best chance of prolonging her life.
Her husband, Ralph Poynter, is, as we speak, down in Washington conducting a vigil with others demanding her release. What do we know about that, Ramsey?
They had a good demonstration in front of the White House and in front of the Federal Bureau of Prisons offices, which were over near Union Station. Dick Gregory was over there with another group. They really caught the attention of some of the staff inside anyway, because there were people in the windows and people coming out and standing on the sidewalk to hear what Dick and others had to say. But whether it'll shake the director loose or not remains to be seen. It's been an intolerably long time to make a simple decision that should have been made on receipt of the warden's recommendation. After all, it's the hospital in Fort Worth that has the direct information, direct contact with Lynn, and knows her condition.
And who is the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and how can we share our thoughts with him?
Well, his name is Samuels. He's a career person who came in as a guard and worked his way up. But he seems to have isolated himself on this issue. People haven't been able to reach him. I've tried to call his office many times and not been able to get through. Somebody always talks to you, but you don't get through to the director. Any letters to Director Samuels, Federal Bureau of Prisons, would be helpful and important. He's being bombarded, but somehow or other he's holding out because he wants an interpretation of compassionate release statute will enable the release of only those who are going to die in the very near future, have no hope of living longer.
His address is on Lynn Stewart's website, lynnstewart.org, and also we'll post it at lawanddisorder.org. If people would write him or call him, it can't hurt. Ramsey, what is your interpretation of the compassionate release statute?
Well, right now it's being applied as cruel and unusual punishment because, day after day, Lynn waits to hear whether she's going to get compassionate release and hears nothing, which is cruel and contrary to the laws of the United States, which direct compassionate release when people are in the physical condition that Lynn Stewart is. It's, the idea of compassionate release is noble. People who are dying should be released for any medical care that might be helpful in extending their lives, but perhaps above all to be with their loved ones in the last days of their life, their family and their children and their friends.
Ramsey, aside from the importance of really a robust people's movement, is there any legal recourse that can be brought at this point?
I think all the lawyers have looked at think it's that the law is too slow, that you need executive action. Executive action is actually required by the statute, but you have a statute that involves the judiciary anyway, and because the sentencing judge has to review and approve. It might be helpful in the future to file a case, but the probability of it expediting action on Lynn's case seems to be pretty slim right now.
Here she is serving 10-year sentence for essentially releasing a press release. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I got Lynn into the case. I tried it with her, and she was lead. I was out by the first 2 or 3 months of the trial in another case. But as she always has, performed brilliantly. But the association with Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman seemed to have tainted her in some sectors of opinion, political opinions particularly. Right now, we have an urgent human matter that a very wonderful woman, human being, and mother and grandmother is dying in prison when her loved ones are yearning to be with her, and she deserves to be with them, and the law requires her to be released, and the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons of the United States is failing to act and do his duty under the law.
Ramsey, it means a lot to all of Lynn's supporters that you are involved in this case at this critical juncture. So I know that our listeners will help mobilize, get letters out, and make calls to urge compassionate release for Lynn Stewart.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and there's nothing more important to me. I love Lynn and owe her a lot for all that she's an inspiring human being, and I hope the world will remember her and remember how she was treated at this time.
Michael, it seems every week there are new revelations in terms of the Snowden case, Bradley Manning, Julian Assange. You're on top of it. What's happening?
I'm too much on top of it, actually, Heidi. I mean, it's exhausting me, but of course it's exhausting people like Snowden and Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and Jeremy Hammond and Barrett Brown and others a lot more than it's exhausting me. But of course, it's been a remarkable week. I mean, you don't live to see these kind of things once in your lifetime. I mean, we saw it in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. No, it's an historical turning point, yeah. I think.
We're at a key moment in this country over its keeping of secrets, its war crimes, its surveillance of all of us, and I know you work deeply on that, Heidi, on surveillance.
So it's been a really historic week. Today, the day we're recording this particular segment, it's June 19th. June 19th has a lot of anniversaries associated with it. It's the anniversary of the execution of the Rosenbergs, who'd been accused and convicted of passing the secret of the atom bomb. We had a segment on them last week by their son, Robbie Mirapol. So it's a time to remember them today. But it's also the one-year anniversary of Julian Assange being in the Ecuadorian embassy. He is still in there. He's having something tonight. I think people are visiting. I'm here, so I can't visit. So I'll talk about that for a minute. But first, let's say a word about Snowden. I mean, it's heavily covered everywhere. We don't know where he is. Massive revelations. But the favorite one was I was in court the other day hearing an argument on an aspect of the Manning case having to do with whether we're going to get more documents about the trial. It was argued by my office in federal court. And this federal court in Maryland actually allows you to bring your BlackBerry in, which is unbelievable, and your iPhone, I presume, and you can actually tweet while you're watching the court and look at your BlackBerry. I mean, that's Baltimore compared to New York, where you do get strip searched before you walk into that courthouse.
Yeah, you have to check your phone. You can't take it in.
You can't do anything. I mean, the courtroom is, and there wasn't even a marshal in the federal courthouse in Baltimore. I was just sitting there on my BlackBerry. I could have taken pictures. I mean, it was so informal compared to what we live with. In any case, I'm sitting there, this is making a long story too long. I'm sitting there listening to the argument about whether we're going to get more documents in the Manning case.
And that's part of the CCR case, Michael.
Yeah, and we've already essentially won because we've already gotten them to turn over almost everything, and now they've agreed to a 1 to 2 day schedule. So the argument was, you know, it's not that it's after the fact, it's what we achieved, and it'll be a decision soon, but because it's on emergency relief, my guess is the judge will say something like, well, you've gotten most of what you want already, but we'll see. So I'm sitting there, and I see all of a sudden that Edward Snowden, is going to do a question and answer, you know, live with the keyboards from some location somewhere, and Glenn Greenwald is asking him questions. Now, I know you've all read it. It's exciting. It's amazing. The guy is highly intelligent. I just want to bring 3 points of that that people may know, but I just found hysterical. This is about being called a traitor by men like former Vice President Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
This is my favorite, maybe. Here's what Snowden says. This is a man who gave us the warrantless wiretapping scheme as a kind of atrocity warm-up on the way to deceitfully engineering a conflict that has killed over 4,400 and maimed nearly 32,000 Americans, and he doesn't leave out the Iraqis, as well as leaving over 100,000 Iraqis dead. And then what you would call the money quote, is that what you call these things? Quote, being called a traitor by Dick Cheney is the highest honor you can give an American. And the more panicked talk we hear from people like him, Feinstein and King, the better off we all are. If they had taught a class on how to be the kind of citizen Dick Cheney worries about, I would have finished high school. And that's from Ed Snowden, a remarkable quote. I think embedded in that quote is also something that I think is important for people to understand, is everybody's arguing about, is Ed Snowden, or for that matter, Bradley Manning, a traitor? They can't say that about Julian Assange because he's not an American citizen. But are they traitors? And it's I hate that debate because it's the wrong question to be asking. The question they should be asking, if you're going to ask about who's a traitor, is Dick Cheney a traitor? Is George Bush a traitor? Aren't those the real traitors? Aren't those the people we held accountable? So I don't like to debate that question because it presupposes that's a relevant debate.
I remember a show in Lai, one of the leaders of the Chinese Revolution, who came from an upper-class family in China, just like Cheney, who's a multi-deca millionaire, or Bush. And they asked Chou Enlai, you've been called a traitor to your class. And Chou Enlai said, yeah, I'm guilty of that. So it's a class question, really. I mean, what Snowden has done, he's done for all of us, not for them. They're the ones who profit from keeping the secrets. In a sense, he is a traitor to them, but to us, he's a hero.
Weighing into this formula that we see is also a kind of character assassination generally, or accusations, say, in the Assange case of sexual misconduct. I don't know if people read the piece by Scott Shane and another reporter in the Times last week that sort of portrayed Snowden as perhaps a little erratic.
This is going on. David Brooks also had a column like that, basically going after Snowden. They've gone after Assange. They went after Manning.
Exactly.
They try and attribute these to, like, personal problems, like, you know, their grandmother killed their cat when they were 3 years old.
And mental instability, for example.
Since then, right, exactly. So I think that's very important.
It's a diversion.
Right, it's very important. Yep. It's a diversion, but it's a way of saying they're acting for personal
interest rather than for the better public good.
Interest or illness rather than for politics or the public good.
With these guys, any stick will do to beat a dog. That's how they view it. And they'll say anything, hoping that the mud they throw up, some of it will stick to the ceiling.
Yeah, I was waiting for the next Alex Gibney movie on Ed Snowden to say, well, he did what he did because his grandma killed his cat when he was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I do think it's a very important point. We should not look at those kinds of things in evaluating the kinds of information they've given us. It's actually almost irrelevant, if not completely. Their political motives may be relevant, but we should look at what they've told us and what Ed Snowden told us about a massive domestic surveillance operation.
And I think what scares people like Cheney is that a lot of American people don't like what they heard. They don't like it. These upper-class figures like Cheney who want to keep it secret, they're worried, and that's why they're slinging the mud.
I happened to watch a segment from the 11 o'clock news on the network last week, and I saw they'd put together really a 2 to 3 minute montage of sort of high profile so-called terrorist attacks, including video from a bicyclist in Times Square from years ago. But what they do is bank on an unaware public that sees this, you know, new captions like new video released of terrorist attack. And along with Obama saying they're declassifying certain information so that they can release to us instances of averting terrorist activity, coupled with the sort of character assassination for the whistleblowers or leakers, I think it's their desperate public relations attempt to do damage control.
Yeah, precisely. They want to scare us. They had General Alexander in front of Congress last week talking about how, because they've been able to have this massive worldwide surveillance of billions of emails and phone calls, they've thwarted none less than 50 possible attacks. And then when it comes down to it, you know, the whole thing falls apart. Most of them are BS, but they're trying to scare us.
I want to talk about that for a second, because that is another, I think, what you're mentioning about scare us is important. They went into Congress this week and they said 50 attacks were stopped. To me, the first question to ask is, why are people attacking us? And that they refused. They refuse to ask. From bin Laden forward, they refuse to ask. They refuse to look at the reasons the very people say why they're doing it. From Palestine to Israel to supporting Saudi Arabia, it's not chance that 17 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, to droning people in Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, all over the place. So let's start from there. And then, of course, if you're going to continue those practices, yeah, then you may have to set up a fortress America, because you're attacking the world and they're going to attack you. So that's the first question. The second thing we're going to see is dragging out these instances. And I must say, if these are the instances, they're pathetic. They're completely pathetic. The two that were mentioned prominently was, the first was concerned some money going to somebody in Al-Shabaab in Somalia that they found somebody was sending Al-Shabaab, quote, terrorist group in Somalia, that has nothing to do with the United States. It's some internal fight going on in Somalia. But in addition, the way they got it was by the guy in Somalia. They didn't get it by finding people here. That's for starters. The second one was a similar kind of thing in Yemen about a so-called bombing that might have happened someday in 1,000 years on Wall Street by some Americans. Same way, they got it by somebody in Yemen, not by here. And as Josh Dreitel, apparently one of the lawyers for the people on the, quote, Wall Street bombing. He said they never even alleged that. They never pleaded to it. It was a complete fantasy. So the two instances they schlep, as I'll say, forward to try and justify a program in which they take in the metadata on every single phone call in the United States and our content overseas are complete BS. It's made up. It doesn't make any sense. Actually, it came out in the testimony that we've only actually looked at the material on 300 phone calls. And so someone said, well, why don't you target things a little more precisely. You're taking in billions of phone calls. I don't want to go there because I don't want to tell them how to do their job. Their job is to tell us what they're doing so we, as the American people, can debate it and discuss it and not put forward, you know, basically false stories of who they've purportedly stopped. And our job is to say, what's going on here, not just in terms of massive surveillance, but in terms of a U.S. empire that, of course, is going to make enemies.
And to bring the point home, because we've been saying this on Law and Disorder ever since we started the show 8 years ago, that this police state that they're setting up extremely successfully and rapidly so far is ultimately aimed at social protest in this country. I saw Karl Rove on Fox News last night, and he was saying, you know, we got to be real careful here. We can't undercut Obama's authority because he's going to have to start going over people's entitlements. And then we saw the news about Detroit, where they've taken away the pensions and medical care of 20,000 Detroit workers. The intelligence that they can garner now on what the American people are thinking and doing can be used against us when we fight back against that taking of our, quote, entitlements. And the proof of that is how they closed down Occupy Wall Street using the same tactics in many cities on the same night. They're very conscious. They know what they're doing.
It's much easier, Michael, to use the metadata to track the activities of emerging activist movements in the United States. It's less effective and indeed makes us perhaps less safe to gather all this metadata and not be able to effectively analyze it to thwart real terrorist threats.
I think that's an important point. I mean, look at Brazil today. Riots in the streets over a 10-cent raise in the subway fare. I mean, I think that's right. I think that what Michael's saying here and you're saying is that's what this is about. This is about knowing where every one of us is all the time, because if they ever have to actually take action against us, which for all I know they're taking already, they'll have the data. A last point on what Ed Snowden said that was close to me and very important to me, and particularly my clients and others, is he took on the claim that Bradley Manning did a document dump while he did a precise dump or a precise look at documents. And he said that's completely untrue. He knows that Bradley Manning was very selective about what he put out and that that's false. And of course, that's what I've been saying for a long time. And the New York Times has been saying for a long time the other way, saying, well, Ed Snowden did one thing, Manning did a dump, Julian Assange did a dump. In fact, Ed Snowden said to his high credit that all of these people have actually selected what they wanted to go out and it's important. The second thing he said was that he supports WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. He says they're publishers and they shouldn't be punished. So Ed Snowden is quite a person, guys, quite a person. The other two quick catch-ups are, as I said, Julian Assange is in the embassy for a year now, as of June 19th. There was a meeting between the foreign minister of Ecuador, Patino, and Haig, who is from the UK. They couldn't agree on a resolution. They've set up a working committee, which means, you know, well, it's just, I won't laugh because we have to get Julian out of there, but it's not very significant. The Ecuadorians are asking, and they filed a legal brief, apparently, asking for safe passage for this person who's been given political asylum, Julian Assange, to go to Ecuador. Julian has said today, or this June 19th, today, that he would, even if the Swedish allegations disappeared or were dissolved or gone, he would not leave the embassy because he's been told that there's a serious chance, high likelihood of indictment in the United States, and whether from England or Sweden, he would wind up in one of our jails. So Julian's situation is not great in that sense, but it's great in other ways. He's doing some of the smartest thinking around all of these issues, from internet to surveillance, including revealing document after document. Bradley Manning's trial is continuing. The prosecution says they're shortening it. It only has 3 or 4 more days. They've stipulated to a lot of testimony. If you go to that trial or read the transcripts, which I recommend doing, and Freedom of the Press Foundation has all the transcripts, and they're really worth a read, both to find out about computers, to find out about their accusations, and also to see how they're trying to smear the publisher WikiLeaks in all of these. They're trying to claim that it directed Bradley Manning to do what he did, et cetera. It's all BS, but they're just spreading it all over the Manning trial. So as we sit here, we have Ed Snowden somewhere in the world, Julian Assange in the embassy, we have Bradley Manning in a prison at Fort Meade. We have Jeremy Hammond, the hacker of Stratford documents, sitting at Metropolitan Correctional Center. We have Barrett Brown, who pasted a link, apparently, to the Stratford documents and has been indicted for that, sitting in a jail in Texas. So it's a real war on whistleblowers, but it's really a war on the United States trying to keep control of all of the information it can and control the internet from the top down, not allow it to play a role in democratizing all of us.
I think the founders of the internet must be appalled by what's going on.
1992. My kids were 3 years old. I mean, I can't believe it's so recent. And it's taken over all our lives, but now it's taken over all our lives by the surveillance state, dominating, controlling it, making it as if it was an atomic bomb that it only could control. And that's, I think, a good analogy because that's what it's trying to do, and it's one that Julian has made.
I think every technological advance has been taken over by the powers that be, from gunpowder up to the atomic bomb, and now they're trying to take over this one. Human rights attorney Professor Richard Falk, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur reporting on condition of the Palestinian people, last week told the United Nations Human Rights Council the Israeli government is collectively punishing 1.75 million people in Gaza and that they're torturing Palestinians held in Israeli custody. What was the United States' response to this? Well, the American ambassador to the Human Rights Council, Eileen Donahue, said that Professor Falk was, quote, unfit, end quote, to serve in his role. What does this show? The power of the Israeli lobby to slander Falk, who's Jewish, they call him an anti-Semite, and to set down American policy with respect to these issues. So we want to give a shout out to Professor Falk and tell him he's got our support and solidarity. And since there's been no formal process lodged to get him out of his office, he's not going anywhere. We'll look forward to more of his good work.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Time in the mid-1800s, when the territory of the Lakota Sioux Indians reached 90 million acres, and now they're separated to tribal councils and relegated to reservations, mostly in North Dakota. Their children have been seized and put into foster homes of white families, and during past Republican administrations, more than 700 Lakota children were taken annually by a private corporation called the South Dakota Children's Home Services. In April of this year, a grassroots movement led by Lakota grandmothers touring the country built support for a formal United Nations complaint of genocide against the United States government and constituent states. We're joined today by attorney Daniel Sheehan, who is chief legal counsel for the Dakota People's Law Project. She had uncovered the institutionalization of state kidnapping of Native children and traced it back to the late William Janklow, a former South Dakota congressman, governor, and attorney general, notorious for the role he played during what the Lakota people call the Reign of Terror on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in North Dakota.
Danny, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning, Heidi.
We're here basically to talk about what seems to be state-sponsored abuse of power in terms of treatment of Lakota children. And I understand that you've been involved in filing a few complaints, one with the United Nations and one with the Justice Department. Can you give us a brief outline of the sequence of events and what you're looking to do?
Yes. The focused time period is during the administration of George W. Bush, between January of 2001 and January of 2009, that eight-year period. There's basically a decade that's involved here, during which the state of South Dakota engaged in a systematic program of the removal of Lakota children from their parents, from their extended families, and from their entire tribe. Some 740 Lakota children a year during that period were taken from their families and tribes, and over half of them were never returned to them. What we've discovered is that that from 87% to 92% of those children in any given one of those years was placed in white foster care. Now, this is a clear violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed by the United States Congress back in 1978 following the major upheaval in South Dakota, the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, the killing of the FBI agents in 1975, and the torrent of killings that took place. Some 42 people that were supporters of the American Indian Movement were killed over the next 2 years. The United States Congress established an American Indian Policy Review Commission at that time, chaired by Senator James Aberesk from South Dakota, to look into what was going on. And they ended up passing through Congress the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was the piece of federal legislation that mandated that if an Indian child were anywhere in the country were taken from the child's parents, they were required to be placed with Native American people within the closest possible relatives to them so they could remain within their culture. Now, this has been absolutely openly defied by the state of South Dakota. They have refused to abide by this. Their longtime attorney general, then governor, then single congressperson, William Janklow, who was the attorney general of the state of South Dakota, who called in all of the federal troops and stuff from the Nixon administration to begin the siege at Wounded Knee. That fellow choreographed this entire operation to defy the United States government and the Congress, and it's resulted in over 5,000 Lakota children now having been taken from their families and basically not returned to them.
I understand that the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which is a convention that the world signed on to in 1948 and America finally joined in on in 1986. And isn't there a provision of that convention that's applicable to what you're describing here?
It turns out that in Section 109(1) of the Genocide Convention, which has now been adopted finally in 1987 and 88 by the United States government in a federal statute, that specifically, Section A6, actually prohibits the systematic seizure of members' children from a minority race or ethnic group by the dominant racial group and placing them in settings outside of their culture. It's considered to be cultural genocide. And this is the nature of the complaint that was filed. There's been a notice, an official notice of intent to file an official complaint with the United Nations. I met with the High Commissioner's Office of Human Rights at the United Nations on June 4th and handed up to them a copy of a complaint that has been drafted by our office, the Lakota People's Law Office in South Dakota, along with the Fox Law Firm, the major law firm in Washington, D.C. and New York, in which a partner in that law firm is, in fact, Byron Dorgan, the former United States Senator from North Dakota, who was the longtime chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs. And Jim Aberesk, who was the chairman of the American Indian Policy Review Commission and the inaugural original chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs, who is the chairman of our board of the Lakota People's Law Office, we've all participated, that law office and our office, in preparing this complaint, which is delivered to the Justice Department of the Obama administration on April 29th of 2013 to an attorney, Verlin Dierenwater, who is the co-chairperson of the tribal rights group and Native American rights group inside the Civil Rights Division. Now, that from April 29th all the way until June 4th, very little, indeed nothing, have been really done by the Justice Department.
Danny, why exactly were the children removed from their families in the first place?
Well, we need to understand there has been a long-time policy, primarily of the Republican Party, that every time the Republican Party comes into power in Washington, D.C., where they have control of the White House and at least one of the houses of Congress, they engage in this process of trying to assimilate the Native tribes, that they're constantly attempting to eliminate their ownership of land and integrate them into the society, basically to eliminate their culture. And when the Democratic Party comes back into power and has control of the White House or one of the houses of Congress, they begin to try to fix the reservations. Neither party ever accepts any kind of challenge to the fact that they took away all 99% of the land from the Native people and put them on reservations. Both parties agree to that. But the Democratic Party constantly tries to fix the reservation, to give them a little better form of government, even though it's kind of a neo-colonial form of government, to try to give them a little more food, a little more health care. But when the Republican Party comes in, they engage in this assimilation process. That was the exact reason why the United States Congress, back in 1978, actually made the move when the House and Senate were under the control of the Democratic Party. They made a move to try to establish the American Indian Policy Review Commission and the Indian Child Welfare Act to stop the states from engaging in that kind of activity of assimilation. What we've seen in the state of South Dakota, under the dominance of Attorney General William Janklow, then Governor William Janklow, then United States Congressman William Janklow, this process of attempting to take as many of the children away as they could possibly do and place them in huge group homes, such as the South Dakota Children's Home Services Incorporated. The bottom line is that the state of South Dakota, under the domination of an extremely reactionary Republican set of administrations, has engaged in a systematic program of attempting to assimilate the Lakota children into the culture and eliminate their Indian culture.
Now, Danny, we also have, as I understand it, a case in which the state of South Dakota has tried to cover up some of what they've been doing. And specifically, I believe Shirley Schwab and Brandon Talaferro tried to assist 7 Native American foster children and then themselves were prosecuted. Is that true?
That is true. That Brandon Talaferro was an assistant state attorney of South Dakota in charge of abuse and neglect cases, and Shirley Schwab was the court-appointed child advocate for the group of Lakota children that were being systematically sexually abused by a set of white foster care parents with whom they'd been placed by the Department of Social Services. And these two state employees attempted to blow the whistle on this and to get those children protected, and the state of South Dakota descended upon them, the attorney general and the prosecuting authorities, and prosecuted them criminally for the alleged unauthorized disclosure of confidential DSS information, for which they were completely exonerated.
Let's go back here to the United Nations, because
yes,
we're all hopeful that you'll you'll get some traction there. I wanted to ask you, first of all, the question of follow the money and who profited by the kidnapping and I understand drugging of these many, many children. So the follow the money question, and then talk to me about how you're going to pursue this at the United Nations.
Yes, there is a subtext to this entire issue, and that is that we've discovered that during the Bush administration, from 2001 to 2009, there was a systematic program of funneling federal funds into South Dakota to finance the seizure of these children, and a substantial portion of that money from the federal government was then being transferred to the pharmaceutical corporations, who were in fact then administering involuntarily to these children pharmaceutical drugs such as Zyprexa, Zoloft, and other psychoactive drugs to allegedly control their moods and their attitudes. It was information, protocol information was being gathered by the drug companies using those children. And huge amounts of money were flowing to those pharmaceutical corporations, who in turn became the principal financiers in many ways of the Republican Party campaigns, including George W. Bush's and the campaign to take over the state, throwing out Tom Daschle, who was the United States Senator from South Dakota, the majority leader of the Senate for the Democrats, and the sole Democratic Congresswoman, Stephanie Herseth, placed by Republicans using that money.
Danny, which pharmaceuticals were involved?
Zoloft and Zyprexa were two of the major pharmaceutical drugs that were not authorized to be given to children under 18 without parental consent.
What company puts those drugs out?
Eli Lilly is one of the major companies.
Talk to us about now, we're in the United Nations complaining about this. Is your law office going to get any traction at the UN?
I believe so. The Georgia Passarelli, who is the human rights officer for the High Commission on Human Rights, is responsible for the complaints in the United States, and she has been very attentive to this. She has received a copy of the complaint that was given to the Justice Department in April. She has officially agreed to begin to monitor the potential response of the Justice Department, and she has agreed to come to South Dakota to begin to gather evidence from the Lakota grandmothers and aunties and others who were refused custody of their children in violation not only of the Indian Child Welfare Act, but of the Federal Civil Rights Act.
Danny, what is happening in terms of reconciling the children who were removed from their homes?
Well, one of the major problems is that the state of South Dakota, which when examined turned out to be number 49 in the country with regard to transparency.
What was number 50?
Number 50 was Georgia.
Oh, okay.
I'm not moving there.
There is one worse, but they refused to give any information about who the children are, where they've been taken, where they've been placed. Some of them have been taken out of the state. We traced a number of them to Utah, to a large mental facility. They've constructed three new youth psychiatric facilities in the state of South Dakota, where a number of them, we've tracked out of the 740 Lakota children a year that were being taken, some 183 of them a year were disappearing into, quote, other institutions. And we tracked a number of them to these mental facilities that we believe were a result of the inappropriate dosing of these children with these pharmaceuticals. And they've had the exact symptoms, the reactions of suicidal thoughts, violent reactions, et cetera, self-mutilation. These are specifically identified symptoms of an inappropriate dosing of these children with these kind of pharmaceuticals, which is why the FDA has prohibited them from having them. So we've tracked some of this. So this is what's happening out there.
Yeah, well, we have great respect for this project. I remember Malcolm X years ago saying we got to go to the United Nations and get a spotlight shown on what's being done to black people in this country.
Yeah.
And you're doing the same thing for the Lakota Sioux. But I have one broader question. Can you give us, in a nutshell, what the Lakota People's Law Project is all about? Where'd you come from? What are you trying to do?
Sure. The Lakota People's Law Project is a subsidiary of the Romero Institute, which is the progeny of the Christic Institute. The Christic Institute is the public interest law firm that we established back in Washington, D.C., back in 1980 when we were doing the Karen Silkwood case. It's the same group that did the Karen Silkwood case. We did the Three Mile Island litigation. We did the major federal civil rights prosecution against the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party down in Greensboro, North Carolina, that killed all those demonstrators back in 1979. We did the American Sanctuary Movement cases down in Texas, and we did the Iran-Contra case that actually generated the Iran-Contra crisis. When the George Bush Sr. Revoked the 501c3 tax-exempt charter for the Christic Institute, saying that the filing of the Iran-Contra case against that administration was a political action, we ended up becoming the Romero Institute. And that is the California-based 501c3 public interest law firm that is the parent organization for the Lakota People's Law Project in Rapid City, South Dakota. We've been there in South Dakota since 2004, working on this case, gathering the evidence, and working with the tribes to get them to focus on this issue, given their limited resources and so many other problems. That of the 3,000 counties in the entire United States, of the 10 poorest counties in the entire United States, seven of them are on those reservations in the state of South Dakota.
Danny, this is truly remarkable work that you've done in the past and now. If listeners would like to check out your website, where should they go?
They go to lakotalaw.org, and it has the entire history of what this project's all about.
Danny, thank you so much for being with us, and we wish you the best of luck and look forward to hearing about positive outcomes.
Yeah, we want to hear from you when this trickles through the UN. Good luck.
Okay.
Thank you, Danny.
Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Law and Disorder is carried on many stations throughout the country, and we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sister stations.
Well, first of all, we have WBAI, New York City, 99.5 FM, WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio in Wisconsin, 96.3 FM, KRFP, Free Radio Moscow at 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho.
WRFN, Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7, Castleloft, Alaska. 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska.
WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts. KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia.
WPVM, 103.5 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana. Online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online.
WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 and 98.3 FM, Columbus Community Radio, Ohio.
KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLRM FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida.
KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Round Radio. AM 1680, Southwest 13.560, Shortwave. Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut.
WJFF Radio Catskill, New York, 90.5 FM. WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99.FM, Bangor, Maine.
You were fishing in Viroqua. KMUD, Garberville, 91.1. KMUE, Eureka, 88.3. KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3. Shelter Cove, 99.5. Voice of Sacramento. Sacramento Community Radio, 88.7. MHC. WWPM, Media Network, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass. KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia 98. FM, Olympia, Washington. WCRS 98.3 and 102.1, Columbus, Ohio.
KSKQ 94.9, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York.
KSVR 91.7, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3, 89.9, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington. WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Mass.
WFTE FM 90.3 and 105.7, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. WRFI 91.9, Watkins Glen, New York. WINO 89.9, Odessa, New York. 88.1, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio. Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes.
KAOS Olympia, Washington, 89.3 FM. KWTF Sonoma County, California. Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas.
KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 106.1 FM. WZRD, Chicago, Illinois, 88.3 FM. Thank you all. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.